Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Zindberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. And welcome to Bookworm. Today, I'm rejoining Elizabeth Wetmore, Beth Wetmore, to talk about how, at age 52, she published her first novel, Valentine, a novel that not only is superb, it made its debut at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. The book is wonderful. An impressive demonstration of the power of women's voices to carry a novel. Now, I'm very interested, Elizabeth, how is it that this is your first novel at age 52? When did you start writing?
Well, I don't think I wrote my first short story until I was in my late 20s. And I was a reader and I loved books and I read voraciously and compulsively as a little girl, if somewhat in a somewhat unfocused manner. And really, you know, I don't come from a background where one becomes a writer, you know, at least not as a profession. So I think that the sort of combination of kind of holding writers in such esteem, I as a little girl and even as a young woman, I thought authors were just otherworldly. They were sages and priests and rabbis and holy people of all sorts. But I did not think of writers as being particularly human or occupying the same, you know, world as the rest of us. So I didn't write my first short story until I was in my late 20s. But I read a lot and I love to read. And I thought it must be a pretty holy profession to spend your time telling stories.
I fell in love with reading and I had a hard time imagining who a writer might be. I confused my teachers with writers. I thought that they and the books they taught me came from some specially magical and creative source, and I felt so lucky that there were special classes. When I was in elementary school, it had the ugly title IGC, Intellectually Gifted Children. By the time I was in high school, it was called AP, Advanced Placement. But whatever it was called, we got to read the best books. One of my teachers took us not to the school library, but to a public library where the head librarian was a friend of hers, and we were able to take out adult books. In this book, your new novel, your first novel, Valentine, one of the characters is reading the Scarlet Letter. There's a beautiful quote, it's not identified, but I recognized it, from Charlotte's Web. She hears the beauty of language. The children who are readers hear that beauty and they find it on the local bookmobile that comes to a nearby parking lot. A parking lot that's near the strip, the strip joint. It's kind of amazing. On the one hand, you have the lost romantic children getting books, and on the other hand, you have the men watching the women taking their clothes off. And that divide is the divide that defines this novel. But at a certain point, Beth, you are at Iowa, the Iowa Writers Program. How did that happen?
when I was waiting tables in Phoenix, I started taking a community fiction workshop. It was being taught by two grad students at Arizona State. And at that particular time, I don't know if they still do this, but at that time, the MFA students had to do some kind of community service project. So these two guys were teaching this community fiction writing workshop, and I sort of made my way into that. And that was where I started. And then at some point I was able to sort of, I wouldn't say sneak in, but I was able to get permission to sit on an MFA level workshop at ASU, and just sort of as a guest. It was really lucky, and I'm not sure it would happen today. But the long and the short of it is I was able to sit in on a class being taught by Ron Carlson, who really encouraged me then to apply to grad school. And, you know, I'm the first generation of my family to go to college. I grew up in a really, really working class background. So honestly, you know, it wasn't until I was in my late 20s that I even really knew that there were such things as MFA programs. You know, when I signed up for that community fiction workshop was when I learned that there were MFA programs out there. So I was encouraged by a mentor to apply, and I did. You know, initially he had said to me, go do some research and come back. And so I went and did a little reading and came back with a sort of list of places to apply. University of Texas, Syracuse. Iowa was not even on my radar until he said, why isn't Iowa on here?
What year is this?
1999. I was at Iowa from 2000 to 2002. And I think it's easy to forget that there are whole swaths of the, you know, the population for whom these kinds of things just are not on the radar at all. Yeah, I mean, for me, one of the biggest things that happened in my life ever, and I would hold it in the top 10 to this day, was the day that Bookmobile parked on that lot, because for me, it meant I could check out books at my pleasure, right? I could just ride my bike up and get them. I didn't have to wait for someone to take me downtown to the one library, you know. So these things were not on my radar, that one could devote one's life to telling stories and to thinking about beauty.
And Beth, you know, you talk about radar. It wasn't on my family's radar either. My parents were the first ones to graduate from night school. I was the first one. You know, it was preposterous that I wanted to be an English major. As they would say at that time, what are you going to do with it? And what I discovered about Iowa is that if you apply, and if they want you, they will give you a full fellowship. So that even if you are, like you, Beth, and like me, working class people, but you write well, and that gift, you can't predict who's going to get it. It's not a gift that belongs to the upper class or the lower class. It's a gift that comes to you from your ability to speak your experience proudly, defiantly, crazily, originally. And if you can, a place like Iowa will want you. And if it's Iowa, guess what? You may get to go there for free. Now, isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it was marvelous. I mean, I think I told you before we started to tape that, you know, on the day I found out that they had let me in, I was literally walking out the door with my waitressing uniform on. And, you know, and until I went to graduate school, you know, I wrote stories at night after I came home from my waitressing shifts. So I would get home from my waitressing shift at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and then I would write until, you know, 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. And that was how I worked, you know, and so it was miraculous for me to go someplace where I could spend 2 years working on my own writing. And in a lot of ways, even more importantly, to be surrounded by people who believed that stories mattered, you know, that they were a matter of life or death, because I had experienced that as a little girl, as a reader. You know, I understood, you know, what stories did for me, the kind of power of stories. But to go to a place where other people believed in the power and the magic of storytelling, and also to start to believe myself that I could be a person who participated in that, not as a reader, but as a creator, was pretty remarkable to me.
I'm talking to Elizabeth Wetmore, the author of Valentine. It's her first novel. She worked with some of my favorite writers at Iowa, including the magnificent Marilyn Robinson. Had you read her before?
I had not even heard of Marilyn Robinson until I found out that I had been admitted to Iowa, I started taking a look around and scampering. And so by the time I arrived at Iowa, I had read everything of hers up until that time, and of course, Housekeeping is probably still to this day one of my favorite books. But between the time I found out I was going and the time I actually threw my cats and my furniture into a moving van and drove that, you know, out of Arizona and headed for the Midwest, then I had read her stuff, and like you, I admire her work deeply. I come back to it often. You know, she's got a new one. Is it out yet? I think it's coming out any minute now, isn't it?
It's next month. Jack, yes, have you read it yet?
No, I haven't, and I can't wait for it to come out. I know the character she's talking about, and he's such a lost sort of grifter type character. I really can't wait to read it. I'm so, so excited.
Me too. And I think, if I'm not wrong, that you got to work with James Allen McPherson, yes?
You know, I did not ever take a workshop with him, much to my everlasting sorrow. And if I had one thing I could do over again at Iowa, that would have been it, would have been to actually formally take a class with him. But I sat in on a couple of his seminars, and he was on my thesis committee. So I was able to sit in his office and have some private meetings with him. And, you know, he's such a remarkable and kind-hearted man, you know, really just was very much in my corner from the get-go.
I was invited to give a lecture at Iowa, and extraordinary Marilyn Robinson was there, yes, but so was James Allen McPherson. And he came up to me and said that I spoke about fiction the way it mattered to him, that it was not theoretical, that I was speaking about it as a matter of passion and dream, and it thrilled him. Then he watched other people come up and hug me, and he came back on the line, and he whispered in my ear, "Can I hug you?" And I said, "Of course. Of course you can hug me." And then one of the teachers there in the poetry department, James Galvin, said that he hadn't seen James Allen McPherson touch another person in years, that this had been a special honor, and it certainly felt like a special honor. And one of the reasons I'm so interested in my guest, Elizabeth Wetmore, is because there she is, coming from working class West Texas, from a family that lives in an oil patch, and she's being, would you call it indoctrinated? Enchanted, I guess is the word, by the people who led me to be enchanted as a reader too, and that those people are so strong that they can work acts of enchantment. I think to this day, a student at Iowa, although it's a completely different faculty, is probably being given the chance of their lives, as my guest, Elizabeth Wetmore, the author of the first novel, Valentine. Imagine, it's so great, writing a first novel and getting it published. She is now age 53. The novel came out when she was still 52. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Elizabeth Wetmore about her marvelous debut novel, Valentine, and the rise of a perspective on writing that led to a fully accomplished debut. Now, Beth, most of the people writing about this book, whether they're reviewing it or interviewing you, say that they can't believe that this is a first novel. Is it really?
It really is. I mean, while I was working on this book, I also wrote a couple of collections of short stories, and this book went through many, many, many drafts. And I guess I was about four drafts into this book when I plucked out about 25 pages and set all the rest of it aside and took those 25 pages. And then Valentine came out of that. So, so I have huge portions of this book in a previous incarnation that I just set aside completely. Yeah, this is my first novel. And I'm surprised when people say that they can hardly believe that it's a first novel, because to me it feels very much like a debut novel, in the sense that it's in a lot of ways a terribly flawed book, you know, and I feel like I see flaws all over this book. And that's okay, because I think if you do it right as a writer, I struggle with a fair amount of impulse toward perfectionism, as I think a lot of writers do. And for me, the way to get around that has been to not only understand that flaws are an inherent part of every work of art, but to actually begin to see those flaws as beautiful in their own right. And so that's been, for me, a real lifesaver as an artist. I work pretty compulsively, and I revise endlessly, and I work very, very slowly. Was it William Gass who said something like, I write slowly because I write badly? And I have to rewrite everything many, many, many times. That is me to a T. My first instincts are never the best instincts, and usually my second instincts aren't the best instincts either. I read aloud constantly. I have to work in solitude, and that can be incompatible with earning a living and taking care of children, you know. So I'm very, very slow. And so this novel very much feels like a debut novel to me.
You know, Henry James considered War and Peace to be a loose, baggy monster. All writers, it seems to me, not only judge one another, they judge themselves, and often very sternly.
Something I heard somewhere is that novels are never finished, they're just abandoned. And for me, someone asked me very recently in an event how I knew the book was done. And the sort of short, jokey answer was, I knew the novel was done when my editor sent me an email and said, in the kindest way possible, no more. We're not taking any paragraphs out. We're not adding any paragraphs. We're done. We can't keep doing this. But the more serious answer was that I knew the book was done when I just didn't have anything left to give it. I had given everything I had in terms of my skill, you know, the skill that I had at the time I was writing the book, and my heart and my soul, and my love for these characters. I just had nothing left to give the book. So, and that to me felt like a pretty good stopping point.
You had to describe a character who was badly hurt. And that disturbance takes place in the very first chapter. The character's name is Gloria. She decides she doesn't want that name anymore. She never wants to hear it again. The man who hurt her used it too frequently. She'd rather be known as Glory now. And she asks people to be sure to call her Glory. What did it feel like to hurt a character so devastatingly?
Oh, God, that is a wonderful question. Well, it was awful. And to this day, I have trouble reading that section aloud. And I steered clear of it for a very long time. And then once I had written the chapter, you know, the question that sort of lingered for me as a writer for the rest of the book, really, and lingers to this day, is having asked a reader to witness that kind of suffering in the opening pages of a book, right? What is my responsibility as a writer to that character going forward? You know, so there were things that I tried to do to treat her and her situation with as a great deal of respect. You know, I steered clear of you know, being too graphic. I focused on the aftermath, mm-hmm. you know, and the fallout from this attack on her and family and her body. You know, but it was, I have to tell you, it was very difficult. And I, even now, I mean, I've read from the book a few times, since the book came out at the end of March. So I've read from quite a bit of the book for different events, and I have yet to read that opening chapter to anyone. So, it turns my stomach a bit, honestly.
Let me put it this way. It turned mine too, but I thought it was very well done. One of the things that happens in that chapter is something that happens throughout the book. Time slows down while the young girl crawls to the nearest ranch. And it's that slowing down of time that is the fingerprint, not just of violence, but also of salvation. She is essentially, as she is being wounded, she's praying as she goes. And when she gets to the door, she comes upon a woman whose whole life will be altered by the vision that justly turned your stomach, turned my stomach, and turns Mary Rose's stomach as well. In other words, we're being reminded that fiction is not always friendly. You will find scenes of immense comedy. You will find love and couples that fit fantastically well together. But you will also find that things hurt sometimes, and they have to.
Yeah, Glory is really, to me, she's the biggest hero in that book. You know, I mean, this is a young woman who literally, you know, saves herself right in the opening pages of the book. And I'm very much interested in how characters, again, without a lot of resources, a lot of money or power or education, find a way to save themselves and to save each other. And how often that happens in really sort of quiet and tender and unexpected ways. One of my favorite scenes in the book is when Glory and her uncle have holed up at the Geronimo Motel, and he's still working at the oil patch, and they're sort of trying to figure out what their next move is. Her mother has been caught up in an immigration raid and deported. They've lost their apartment, and they're sort of holed up in this hotel. He's going to work, and this young woman, you know, is trying to heal, basically, in the aftermath of this horrific attack. And of course, you know, this is not a young woman who would have had access to, you know, counseling, right? Or any sort of real tangible help. help. What she has is this swimming pool and this motel room and the ability to be quiet and to be left alone, right? And there's this wonderful moment in that chapter where she gets into a swimming pool for the first time, and this completely unexpected character, this woman named Tina from Lake Charles, Louisiana, sort of reaches out while they're floating in the pool and just sort of touches her hand, right? And it's the first time that Glory's been touched by anyone other than nurses or doctors since this awful crime, right? Since the rape. And I love that moment, you know, because I can't imagine that Tina thinks of herself as particularly heroic, right? And I don't think Glory thinks of herself as particularly heroic, but there's this tender moment of contact between this woman and this girl. And for Glory, that's a really important moment. You know, that's a moment where she sort of turns a corner a little bit. And for me, the whole book is full of those moments, because to me, in my life, that's been my experience, right? Of how salvation works, right? How helping each other work, how love works, which is that, you know, it's really often in sort of quietest moments that we're able to really reach out to one another, however temporarily, however briefly, and really make a change.
Well, Tina's an amazing character, because first she sends her two children out of the pool. Her son has been calling Glory names. And she says, I never want to hear those names coming from your mouth ever again. Not now, not ever. And she turns to Glory. They intertwine. It's not just that they touch. They intertwine fingers. Mm-hmm. It's a crazy scene. Mm-hmm. It's very moving. Yeah. Tina is sort of a madwoman, and it's wonderful to meet her. And I want to tell my listeners that this book, Valentine, by my guest, Elizabeth Wetmore, is full of wonderful revelations. Yes, I agree with you. Of course, it's not a perfect book. How could it be? But it's a book full of wonderful surprises and revelations. I've been talking again with Elizabeth Wetmore, author of Valentine, published by Harper. Thank you, Elizabeth, for joining me again.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's been wonderful to talk to you. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and all other podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to Bookworm's collaborators, Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan, production manager J.C. Swadek, and technical director Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just reading this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Edmund White is our guest.